Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Sir Chad Wise O'Reilly.
Oh, hey, Eddie.
Oh, yes, we are in Tommy Wiseau fever. We are just fresh from the theater. We saw a really interesting film. We actually saw a couple really interesting films
today.
We
have a double feature
to
share this time.
But we are not alone.
We are not.
We have with us returning for his second appearance. Second appearance?
Second appearance.
We got Spencer Williams. What is up, Spence?
Hey, what's up, everyone?
So we got, like we said, like Chad said, we got a double feature for you. So stick around as we dive into that. The Filmlosophers are presented with no commercial endorsements and just a little bit of green screen magic by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. You can mutter and stammer your way through our entire library on Google Play, Libsyn, Stitcher, Player FM, Audio Boom, or iTunes any day of the week. Then once you're all caught up, new episodes debut each Wednesday. If Hollywood news and views are tearing you apart... That was good.
So good.
Conversation is always welcome on our social pages. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I. So, yeah, like we said, we got a great show in store for you. We are actually, like Chad said, doing a double feature, and we're going to be talking about two movies, not one. I think it's been a long while since we've done this, actually.
We've not done it in a long time, yeah.
And I think the last time we did it was with the... Animal... When we did it with the Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book and...
Zootopia.
Else? Yeah, Zootopia, yeah.
Animal...
It's been a minute.
Animal something. We said something like that.
And just think, that one had like anthropomorphized animals.
That's what
in common
it
with each other, right? This episode has Tommy Wiseau as the thread.
It's almost the same thing.
It's almost the same thing. Spencer, this is why we have you back.
There you go. So we are talking about, if you haven't gotten the clue quite yet as to the films that we are talking about the 2003 film, the cult classic, The Room, starring Tommy Wiseau.
And written by, and directed by, and produced by.
All of the above. And we are also talking about...
Hey, it's important to note. I mean...
No, it's very important to note.
This guy...
This guy did the most.
It's
the only way you can
most.
Say
it. and somehow we're... also the least, but also the most.
And we are also talking about the 2017 film that is actually chronicled all the happenings that were going on behind the scenes for that film, according to the actual novel it's based on,
right.
Written by one of the actors on the film. So yeah, we're gonna kind of dive into those. In the cult classic 2003 film, The Room, Johnny is a successful banker who lives happily in a San Francisco townhouse with his fiancée, Lisa. One day, inexplicably, she gets bored with him and decides to seduce his best friend, Mark. From there, nothing will be the same again.
All I have to say is, that is more than I knew about this movie after having watched it.
That's true.
That synopsis, I didn't know it going in, and I sure as heck didn't really understand all that happened within the film. I mean, I'm being a little facetious. Obviously, these are the main story. Well... These are the main plot points. I won't go so far as to call it a story.
Oh, no, don't.
The main happenings of this event that they call a film. I don't know. I don't know how generous to be.
Like, if any movie deserved the title A Series of Unfortunate Events, it's kind of this movie.
you almost wonder if, like, Tommy Wiseau is just a character that was created by, like, Lemony Snicket and has just been let loose on the world and...
He's the embodiment of a fictional character. That's why he doesn't have a background, an age, nothing.
So
here's the thing, though.
Go ahead.
One question that I still don't have the answer to, why is it called The Room?
Because it made more sense than a room. It's The Room because it's a place where people can get along with each other.
But, you know, so okay. Hold on. So let me take a quick step back before we kind of continue
this
conversation.
There's no stepping back. From where we've been over the past 5 hours of our real world lives, there's no going back.
That is true. But I do have to say this. We had been poked and prodded on this film for some time as to us needing to watch it. We had talked about it earlier. I had seen parts of it from someone who had watched it at home or whatever a few years back. I had no interest in seeing it.
But likewise.
But you hear about the rumors. You hear about that one film. You know, oh, did you hear about The Room? And I'm like, you mean Panic Room with, you know, Jodie Foster? Like, no, The Room.
Oh, no, I straight up remember when this film came out. Again, I use the word film lightly and loosely. This piece of work. I remember when it came out because I remember I was watching like an Entertainment Tonight or an Extra or an Access Hollywood, one of those. And they were showing a clip from one of their beat reporters interviewing Tommy Wiseau and asking, like, how much money did you spend on this film? Oh, you know, it's not important, you know, whatever. And you can't, he's somewhat difficult to understand unless you're used to his cadence.
Yeah.
And even then, sometimes it's, you know, I was looking at you guys like, what did he just say? I don't know. Because, you know, he's from New Orleans, so not really. But he keeps saying he's from New Orleans. Anyway, I remember when the movie came out, there was a lot of like low-level conversation about, okay, who is this guy? Because he bankrolled this entire project on his own, and it's terrible. But people are really enjoying how terrible it is. So who is this guy? And I remember seeing an interview or two with him and quickly losing interest, quite frankly. But they were interested for a short while.
But I state that this is the movie that we've talked about. But one of the biggest proponents to us needing to see this movie is sitting at this table, because every time we talk about movies,
there's that laugh again. We've experienced this laugh numerous times today, folks. By the way,
so we have all been friends for a while, and when we started this podcast, one of the things that Spencer had brought up is, oh, you guys should watch The Room. You guys should review The Room. You guys should do The Room. And we're like, I don't know. Like, I just haven't heard enough good stuff about it to really want to sit through that.
It's hard to muster up any form of interest, given the stories that you hear.
And so with the Disaster Artist coming out and finally making its way to theaters this weekend, we were like, all right, Spence, you know, we'll cave in. We'll go and see The Room, and then right after we'll go and watch The Disaster Artist. But you're going to have to be on the show. And of course, Spencer was all down for that. So,
and here you sit. Oh, look what you hath wrought upon yourself.
I'm very happy.
Had you seen The Room before?
Bits of it.
You're in the same boat.
Okay, because
this entire time I'm like, all right, well, this must be like a favorite of Spencer's. This must be one of those movies where like he must have like a collection. He's got a Tommy Wiseau bust on in the corner of his room.
Oh, mercy.
He has the sunglasses that he wears, and you've only seen bits and pieces of this, and you subjected us to this all day?
Yeah, because I stand by
we
it
saw Tommy Wiseau's butt. For you.
Okay, I knew to look away from the screen then.
Oh, that's... Twice!
Okay, we are seriously going to need to talk about that whole mess in about 4 minutes when we get there. But
I just wanted to emphasize...
So I'm the only... Let's clarify. So I'm the only person at the table who has never seen whole sequences. I've seen, like, the famous, you know, You're Tearing Me Apart and...
Lisa.
And... Sorry, excuse me.
Because then you're going to get it mixed up with...
So I've seen that sequence a few times in like clip compilations and whatever, and I've seen a couple other small things, and obviously the recreation of the rooftop scene with James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, mm-hmm. as, you know, a preview trailer for The Disaster Artist.
Yeah.
I've seen that version of that scene, but I've never seen entire sequences of this film, certainly not the whole thing, and I did not know what to expect other than a general sense of incoherence.
Yeah. So like we said, this film was directed, written, produced, and starred by the mysterious Tommy Wiseau, but the film also stars Greg Sestero, Juliet Daniels, and many others that you will probably never hear about. The Disaster Artist, on the other hand, was directed and starred by James Franco, and actually contains a stellar cast of his brother David Franco, Seth Rogen, Ari Grainer, Alison Brie, Zac Efron, Josh Hutcherson, and many other notable names.
Yeah, there are a lot of celebrity cameos in The Disaster Artist, beyond what you've seen in the trailers and mm-hmm. stuff.
Being odd and off-color, the movie, The Room, is often referred to as the, quote, Citizen Kane of bad movies. Spencer, does that name actually qualify for this film? Like, is this the Citizen Kane of bad movies?
I think so, because like when you think of bad movies, this is the one that comes screaming to mind, because there's nothing else that's quite such like that's cohesively incohesive.
And I'm not and wow,
that's brilliant.
It makes sense when you see it.
And I'm not poking fun at Spencer. What I'm doing is I'm actually asking out of the knowledge that Spencer has, because Spencer is our resident B movie expert.
He is, actually. He's got a lot of knowledge about this subgenre.
When he talks about, have you seen Birdemic? Or have you seen...
Or Birdemic 2.
Or Birdemic 2, or all these other... I sat with Spencer, and I watched the worst B movie. I would see The Room 10 times in a row than ever see this horrible movie that we saw that was just bad, which, by the way, I almost bought for you for Christmas, but it was out. Apparently, the one copy that was on Amazon was sold. But
they made copies of that thing. I vetoed.
You were smart.
I left The Room. Well, not The Room. I left this other experience from this other film that we're not talking about today, and I went into a different place and fell asleep.
According to Greg Sestero, Tommy Wiseau actually submitted the film to Paramount, hoping to get them as a distributor. Usually it takes about 2 weeks to get a reply, but the film was rejected within 24 hours.
There's a lot of kind of backhanded exceptionalism about this project. Like, the budget for what you get out of it, exceptional in a bad way. The submission to Paramount and the immediate turndown, that's an exceptional result in a bad way. Like, so it's like a backhanded exceptionalism that kind of characterizes a lot about this project.
Spencer.
The Room specifically, not The Disaster Artist,
no.
Which I thought was remarkably, even though it's completely based on and in some ways in love with its subject matter, mm-hmm. it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed almost every minute of it.
And speaking of The Disaster Artist, the film actually made its rounds earlier this year in the film festival circuit. The film received a standing ovation after the premiere of the South by Southwest Film Festival back in March. So that only just adds more to what Chad is talking about The Disaster Artist. But before we jump into The Disaster Artist, we have to talk about one other movie, which is The Room. So in our normal... I can see the dread on Chad's face.
All I have to say is, based on the feedback that the two of you gave me while we were viewing The Room, my face has said it all day.
Oh, no. I think, Spencer, what did you say while we were watching The Room when I mentioned that Chad's face was priceless during the entire thing? You said something about him adding to the experience.
Oh, yeah. He made the experience for me. Like, at some points, I was just watching Chad versus the movie because that was so entertaining in itself.
It was.
It was like everything that I had feared and more.
I think real, and not to kind of spoil anything or whatever as we just jump into that, but I think this movie could be summed up in one word, and that word is something that a friend of ours had said about another film in terms of describing it. And it'll ultimately be living in infamy for the rest of God knows how long as we, you know, encounter horrible films. And that is, this film was booty.
Is this your idea of a segue? No. It is. It is. You're going to segue straight to the booty.
What?
You are. Just do it.
Oh.
So, just rip off the scab. Just get it over with.
So this movie... Let's just, real quick, let's give a little bit of actual content.
No, it doesn't matter where you start. Just
it sadly really doesn't.
There's no. Like, you kind of, for about half of a second, think, oh, maybe. And then before you even get into the whole, like, this isn't as bad as they say, you're already shutting yourself up.
This was, no, I don't even think you have a point in this film where that happens. Right from the get-go, like, the immediate walk through the door, the awkward interaction of the first 5 minutes, the immediate jump to sex, which...
Within the first 5 minutes.
Which, so, I have to say...
After the pillow fight...
The awkward pillow fight with the underage...
The worst. He's not underage.
I don't know what he was.
They said at one point later on that he was 18 when Tommy found him alone.
He's just this,
or
like...
Johnny. Excuse me. I keep doing this. I can't distinguish performer from character.
Because they're almost the same person.
I don't know that there is a distinguishing point.
Sadly, I don't think there is. But so as that scene continues on... Like, it literally, it's beat by beat. Walks in through the door, gives her a dress. She gets excited. Denny, this man-child, walks through the door.
No, get it right. The pervy man-child.
The pervy man-child.
He
with,
is clearly...
With the bowl cut.
Not. You're, like, it's... Everything about that character is not working from jump.
And then they go upstairs. Denny was, I guess, supposed to leave. And then... Goes upstairs and follows them because he likes to, quote, watch them.
Okay, first of all, no. First, he stays downstairs, pulls an apple out of I don't know where, bites
that,
it,
that is,
and like
yeah, I don't
looks,
know where that...
looks up the spiral staircase that they've just gone upstairs, like in a
pervy... I'm gonna go up
okay,
there.
Okay, wait, let's back up, though. He comes out of nowhere into their home space. You don't know who he is or why he's there. You can't tell exactly how old he is or mm-hmm. what his connection to them might be, and they never define it really until much, much later. There's a yep. little bit of backstory sort of given. And then they're like, well, we want to get our freak on upstairs. And he's like, okay. And then they go upstairs and he like pervy watches them go upstairs. And then they go upstairs and have this weird, awkward pillow fight. And he yeah. comes upstairs and joins them and tells them to their face, I like to watch you. This is not normal, number one, or in any way okay, number two. This is in the first, like, 3 minutes.
Yep.
And by minute five, he has been banished downstairs. They have their clothes off, and they're going at it.
There's no indication either that Denny goes out, like, he leaves the
no.
apartment. Like, so he could have ultimately just been downstairs or been by the stairwell and watched.
Oh, my gosh.
So the first of many sex scenes occurs in the first 5 minutes, which is really awkward. And it was funny because I so when we were watching, my first thought was this, but it wasn't until we saw the disaster artist that it was confirmed. I'm like, his body position is kind of awkward, but I mean, hey, I'm not one to.
But
judge.
I mean, hey, to each his own. No, here's the other thing that happened. For those who, you know, those we're not going to go off the rails into all of this descriptiveness
no,
because, you know, we do want to be a family-friendly show. But you should know
this
that
is not a family-friendly movie.
This is not
movie.
A friendly, family-friendly movie.
No.
But we watched it. We were streaming the film mm-hmm. in a home space. We didn't go to a theater to watch like a rebroadcast or whatever. So there are numerous... sex sequences or sensual sequences. We fast forwarded through them is what I'm getting at, mm-hmm. which was great to get through all that because I doubt that anything of substance happened there because nothing yeah. of substance really happened anywhere else.
If there was no engaging dialogue in the actual film, there wasn't going to be anything engaging.
But like this is full on like cheesy saxophone music like that. Yeah. Like just not. Okay. It wasn't Kenny G.
They couldn't afford him.
No. Well, I don't know.
$6 million.
Who knows how much money this guy has? I don't know. But they didn't choose to afford
oh,
him.
Hi, Kenny.
The worst. The worst. They would compare hair care products. Anyway, there are four sequences, I think, if I remember correctly, that we fast-forwarded through. And it was always remarkable. Like, we're going through it, and it's like, how long does this sequence go? And then how long does the next one go? And it is remarked upon in The Disaster Artist when they're doing the screening of the film for the first time to the first audience ever. And they're sitting there like, when is this going to be over?
That's so true. One of the actresses is like, it's still going. I'm like, I said the same thing.
It's too much. So thankfully, we skipped past all the super gross stuff.
But we didn't skip past far enough, because as we get back to the next morning, which this film has an issue with continuity. Like, I couldn't tell if one day had passed, 2 minutes had passed, or a whole week had passed.
And sometimes it's literally like that. Like, sometimes it's like a day passed and it's suddenly the next day and you're like, oh, wait, when was the indication? And then other times it's like you've had eight scenes that it should have taken them 2 days, but clearly they're still at the end of the same day.
And there's sometimes where, like, you'll be in a scene, it transitions away to, like, this screensaver thing, then it transitions back to, like, 2 seconds later. It's like, why did you do that?
So it's bad.
It's they must have paid all of that money to San Francisco B-roll.
Yeah, I mean, they seriously, I mean, and not, the B-roll is not consistent either.
No.
The establishing shots, like some of them of Alcatraz, I was noticing in the very beginning, there's a shot of Alcatraz Island, and there is a container ship going by in the background, and it is clearly from a time-lapse camera setup, because the container ship goes, like, moves as a jolt, and then refreshes, and then moves as a jolt, and refreshes. Like, it's not even...
That's bad.
Film speed is not synchronized between all the cameras that they're using. Anyway, it's
laughable. We digress. We digress from the current conversation at hand, which, as we've said, is summed up in one word: booty.
Booty.
So the next day after,
way to bring it back, Eddie.
After the boom boom time, Tommy Wiseau gets out of bed, and as he
gets, character's name is Johnny.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. No, I know.
Johnny gets out of bed. And as he gets out of bed and walks to one of the side room, which I'm assuming was the bathroom, full scope, Johnny's butt. That's just, it was too much for the first 8 minutes of the movie.
There's too much of all kinds of everything happening in this movie.
But
also, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm really hung up on the fact that they, when we say that there are multiple sequences in this film, they are not multiple sequences involving the same characters. There's, because as you so eloquently read in your film synopsis, she, like seduces Johnny's best friend, Mark.
Mark.
So they have a sequence or two thrown in there at different points. Then there's this whole other random couple that comes into their home space.
Yeah.
You don't even know who they are or why they're there. They don't have any purpose. They come in. Apparently they're students. I don't know. They're 20-somethings, but they're students.
Yeah.
And they do the nasty and leave, and then other characters come in after them. And, like, it's just, it's so incoherent. Like, there's no purpose. And you regularly have new characters being introduced for no reason.
It's true. There's no proper character introduction or development on anybody, because, like, the scene that Chad's talking about, as they are cut after the fact by the Lisa, the woman living there, and the fiance and her mother, Lisa jokingly says, oh yeah, they use the place, they come in so that they can
do homework.
Study.
Yeah.
And it's like, so your house is like a common area or something? It's like
between Denny and then these two people and who knows who else.
So
yeah, no. And the mother, by the way, it was meant to be, I guess, sort of a voice of reason, but like very, very like parchment transparent cheap way is used as a narrator sort of to describe, like, basically the daughter when you first meet the mother, because they have a series of like sit down chats in the living room of this space, because in spite of spending $6 million on this movie, they only had two sets and like some on location filming a couple of times. So the mother and the daughter are talking with each other. Lisa expresses to her mother that she doesn't love him anymore and she wants to leave him and go be with his best friend instead. And the mother proceeds for like 2 minutes straight to talk about all the things that are great about Johnny. Like he has a steady job and he's going to provide for you and he's good to you. Like, it's all the things that the imaginary, you know how you have a vision of yourself in your mind. You're like, I hope people see me this way. He wrote that into the like future mother-in-law's mouth. Like, and she's the one sharing this idealized vision of what he most likely sees in his own mind about himself slash his character. It's very like inappropriately meta. Like, it's
well,
odd.
And the interesting thing about it is that a lot of the time, so throughout this entire film, you only understand his morals, I guess, and his response to emotional times and his ability to do what he can do as a man. Your only information out of that is given to you by the mother-in-law.
The potential future mother-in-law. The potential future mother-in-law. Because they're engaged, but not yet married.
But the only times you see Johnny and Lisa interacting are when he's coming in the door and they're having sex. That's it.
Pretty much,
the only times you recognize their interactions together.
Until, you know, later on when they start getting into fights and stuff, but...
You know, the interesting thing about, like, the mother-daughter talks is that there's, like, three or four throughout the movie, but they're all the same talk. Like, it's just like
they
a
really
loop,
are.
Except for one.
Except for one that doesn't make any sense.
Oh my gosh. And this, that, so, and it's funny because it's like, it's so ridiculous that anybody who goes to a, goes to any movies, they're like, all right, well, let's hope this pays off at the, in like maybe the third act or the second act
right.
or even. So there's a conversation that the mother has with her daughter. Oh, yeah, I went to the doctor. It's been confirmed. I have breast cancer. And that was it. That was the whole entire thing.
Yeah, she was like,
in
oh,
the
you'll
middle
be
of the conversation.
Fine.
In the middle of the conversation.
Yeah, and the daughter's like, oh, it's going to be fine, Mom. And then they move on to something else entirely. And you never, ever hear about it again.
And we're like, wait, there are whole movies based around that particular scenario. So... Going into that movie and seeing that particular scene and then as the film ends, not having it kind of, you know,
matter?
Given it, yeah, not having given it closure.
Not having it matter at all.
Although it's been said that somebody has actually approached Tommy Wiseau and asked him about this particular storyline. And apparently in his mind, in whatever sequel that he's created in his brain.
Oh, mercy.
That she's actually survived the breast cancer. So she's still alive, potentially.
The word sequel should never be associated with this project in any way.
Yeah, because what?
Nor should
it
the
would
term
be called
adaptation.
The Room 2, The Foyer.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So one of the other things that I think this film really suffers from is god-awful writing. I mean, if there was... so
like, pretty much literally the worst.
In my mind, I write weekly for like certain, you know, things that I do outside of here, but it's not anything to like a professional status like people who...
Like a multi-million dollar film project?
Exactly. And one of those people that I've always kind of held in high regard in this was Chad, because Chad is an actual screenwriter. Like, he's actually created stuff. Plus, he's a huge wordsmith.
Unproduced. We should put unproduced on there, because I haven't... Like, you cannot look me up on IMDb and find things that I've written.
I don't know. Maybe you're... If Tommy can do it, you can do it. We're going to do a pinky promise.
I will raise my water glass to that. Yes.
But knowing that we were watching this film and... hearing everything that was being said, I'm like, I can only imagine what is going through Chad's head as we are listening to this atrocious dialogue and this conversation between two individuals, or even just a character introduction into a scene, you know, oh, hi, Mark, you know, that kind of thing.
If you can imagine a person's eardrums being curled in upon themselves in the fetal position, that's probably what my eardrums looked like during most of this film. This project. I keep calling it a film, and I keep stepping back away from that term. Because I cannot bring myself to do it.
Spencer, what were your... I'm still thinking about the dialogue. What were your thoughts in terms of like the way the movie just spoke?
Like,
if you want to call it that.
Good, when I feel like I could write a better movie. With just like Microsoft spell check.
And you're right. You are absolutely correct.
Yeah, so, like, like the, oh, hi, Danny. And like, why is his name Danny? Like the only
Danny. Number one, it sounds like Danny in the entire first sequence.
Well, when we first saw it, I was like, oh, Danny. And it Spencer so, you know, nicely replied that, oh, no, it's not Danny. It's Denny, like the restaurant.
Like Denny's.
And I'm like, why? And that's another pet peeve of this stupid movie.
Like the restaurant.
And it's like the naming convention. So let's just kind of talk about the naming convention real quick. There's a character in this movie. He's not, I mean, he's in one scene.
Yeah.
But he's introduced as Chris R.
Very specific.
What does that mean? Like, that.
There's not another Chris in the movie, by the way. This is the only Chris in the movie, but he's very specifically Chris R.
I'm like, is that symbolic of, I mean, that might give it, so we talked about it and we're like, me and Spencer were like, oh, well, maybe this is an homage to this, or maybe that scene was an homage to like Reservoir Dogs. And what did you say, Chad?
I don't remember, but basically the thought is
don't give this
don't give this movie more credit than it
deserves. Exactly. Like,
or more depth than it was.
Don't even try to read in like things like homage or what, like even the famous tearing me apart bit that is a direct ripoff of
James Dean
in Rebel Without a Cause. Even that, we know that it's a direct ripoff slash homage, I guess you could say. I would not call that an homage. Like, it's just
a
really
rip-off.
Terrible ripoff.
So I've mentioned Spencer being our resident B-movie expert. Out of this particular B-movie, what scene stood out for you as the most B-movie-esque?
Oh, there's so many to choose from. That's such a hard question. Because, like, really, this whole sequence with Chris R. is so great. Of just like, where's my money, Danny? And you're like, what? Who are you? And then everyone's rushing up. And, like, they take away Chris R., and then just come back, and I'm like, was there a police officer downstairs? Do you have a jail cell?
For as high as that building
looked. They don't have his gun. Like, they apparently gave the gun back to him or something.
Yeah, he's just out of
the movie. Never mind. Maybe that's the gun that comes back later.
Oh.
It might have been the same gun. Ooh,
because
I'm trying too hard.
I was
going
to say, Chad, I'm about to tell you what you said to me.
I need to take my own medicine on this one. I am trying too hard. Okay.
Like, for me,
dial it back.
One of the B-moviest B-movie-esque scenes in this film has to be that short yet ridiculous flower shop scene.
Yes.
Oh, that was
yes.
so good.
That was ridiculous. Was so and it was like...
That scene was this movie in a nutshell.
Yeah.
It was like the entire scene had no audio from that particular scene. It was all overdubbed. And it was like, you're my favorite customer. It's like what you would hear if you were playing a video game and you ran into like one of the, you know, computer AIs. It's like, you are a great warrior.
And it didn't matter at all. It had no bearing upon the flow of the story in any way, shape, or form. It was a complete waste of film and time and digital space, apparently, because as we've learned, he filmed everything two ways.
In
film and digital. So it was like a double negative, essentially. Double didn't matter. And that's really, to me, indicative of the entire film. It does bring a lot of people joy to talk about the experience of seeing this project. But honestly, at the end of the day, it doesn't add anything to your life.
No.
And it could be argued that it takes away certain things.
I lost
well.
Years from seeing this movie.
Honestly, I mean, this movie's been out since 2003, so I think it's not a spoiler to go straight to the end. Where you have a fight between
Mark.
Johnny.
Mark. Okay, I'm Johnny. Like, Tommy? No, Tommy's the real guy's name. Johnny. Johnny and Mark, the best friends, who are both fighting over the girl that they both slept with numerous times and kind of have known. It's blasé, but it's meant to mean something, but who cares? And they have this big argument at Johnny's birthday party, and ultimately, Johnny ends up upstairs. Oh, in the room.
Don't even.
And upstairs in the bedroom area.
And the great thing is that the way you're setting it up, gives, even that gives it way too much credibility, because the structure on how it reaches these steps are
mess.
So wobbly.
I would like to remind you, during that fight sequence, Johnny says to Mark, "Well, you're just a little chicken." Cheep, cheep, cheep.
And pushes him into a door and almost breaks the set, by the way.
And then, not even that, like seconds before, they had a fight prior to that second fight. And they both shook hands and they're like, "All right, bro. You okay, bro?"
Yeah, but not even that normal. But yes.
No.
But then immediately go back into it. Anyway, he ends up in the bedroom.
We were dumbfounded for a quick second.
And I have to say, I feel morally compromised as a human being.
This was great.
Ever since I was a young boy and I had I was exposed to the unfortunate reality of suicide through a mentor figure to me, committed suicide, and it scarred me. It scarred me deeply, and I it's my least favorite subject in the world. I don't like to talk about it, even as an adult. When I'm a big boy, I can talk about it, but I don't want to. I don't like it when it happens in movies.
Yeah,
and you get to the end of the room. And I feel morally compromised because I'm like, can you just get it over with? And not necessarily like Tommy Wiseau as a performer, but like this movie needs to be over. This project needs to end. It's a train wreck and a half. I will never get this hour and a half of my life back.
Nope.
And I really wish I could. And
I'm not.
So as you're watching this character go through it for the first time in my life, I essentially, in not so many words, said, like, just go ahead and do it. Like, just be done. Like, be done with this. This needs to end. And I feel terrible. I feel like a terrible human being for this.
Would you rather watch it again? And
No.
Okay, thank you.
I never want to see it again.
And we're not even going to talk about, like, that whole end scene, like, that last 5-6 minutes of the movie, which is just a ridiculous execution of scenes where he's oddly throwing stuff around, and then he finds the red dress. He does something with the red dress, which is really awkward. And then after he even...
Please, let's not ever bring that to mind again.
And then after he does, you know, commit suicide, just happens to, you know, the two, Lisa and his best friend Mark, happen to come upstairs, and that whole... The way that whole end scene transgresses, and Denny shows up, and there's some type of siren coming in the distance, but it seems to never actually get there. And like,
what did you say? The ambulance is driving up the stairs.
The ambulance is going up the stairs and down the hall or something, because it just seemed to keep getting louder and louder. And then there were voices that were coming out of nowhere, like, oh my gosh, look, what's it going to happen? What's going on there? Oh my gosh, look, what's that? And it's like, who is talking? It's like, who is like making these voices?
The worst.
And then they were going to potentially leave Denny with the body for a quick second.
Well, he told them to leave, but and they almost did, but then they came back anyway.
Because they weren't worthy.
That's an excellent point. You've made probably the most cogent point of the entire podcast just now.
They were not worthy. So that's ultimately The Room in a quick nutshell. But we kind of transition over into The Disaster Artist, which is a film, like we said, that kind of chronicles the actual happenings behind the scenes of this
film.
Wait,
can we rate this? I have a good rating for it.
Sure, we can rate it now. Wait, hold on. Does it pass or fail? And how many months?
Oh, it totally fails for me. And as for my rating, it's not even a monocle rating. It's just a general rating of -0. That's when you go to negative infinity and beyond.
Okay, I get that. That
negative
makes
zero.
So much sense.
Thank
Spencer,
you.
Does it pass or fail in your mindset, and how many monocles?
Yeah, okay. We're going to have to switch over to like the B movie list for me of like,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Smart okay. Play.
For this one, I'm,
so you're saying we have a chance?
Yeah,
is what Tommy Wiseau is saying.
For like me, this movie really passes because it's just a magnificent train wreck of a movie. Like,
I don't even know if I could call it that.
Oh, yeah, it's not really moving.
Let him know. Go ahead.
A magnificent train wreck of moving images across a screen. Like,
are you rating the film or the stock footage?
The screensavers, as you called them.
I definitely think it's like worth a check out if you like B-movies and just want to see something ridiculous with your friends. Fast forward through all the sex scenes because you don't have time in your life for that.
They really do take up a lot of time on this
so
film.
So much. Like, I think this movie's like an hour and 40 and we were done in 50 because we skipped over all the sex scenes.
Let that be a lesson to you.
So, 8 out of 10 on the B-movie.
8 out of 10 on the B-movie scale for you. Mm-hmm. I feel like with as good as you're talking about it, I feel like, you know, much like the Kool-Aid man, Tommy Wiseau is going to bust through this wall and saying, oh, hi, Spencer.
Honestly, though, would that make your evening, though, if he did do that, Tommy Wiseau?
Oh, that would be
sunglasses
crazy.
And all.
I would be very into the rest of this podcast and how that would be with the four of us.
Oh. Tommy, if you're listening...
Yes, Tommy Wiseau, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the show and tell us what's going on in that head of yours. As a pass or fail, I'm going to have to pass it because of the fact that it did achieve what I expected to get out of it, which was confusion and just random amusement. It was... fun to watch, especially in a group setting. Like, if I was by myself and I saw it...
I was going to say, it's different if you're with people versus not.
Like, if I was by myself, it totally probably would have failed in that instance. But as a group and seeing individual reactions and seeing how what everybody has hyped this film up to be, and it not only achieves that, but even more so in terms of its just ridiculousness, I think it passes for me on a scale of 1 to 5 monocles, however. I will give it a 0.2.
That's like a link in the chain.
That seems like a lot.
It's only a 0.2 because of the...
I think you're overreaching.
That's as much as I can give, and that's being generous. So, with that, we transition over to The Disaster Artist, which, like we said, was a chronicling of what happened behind the scenes by... the actor Greg Sestero, who played Mark in the film.
Who turns out to have actually been best friends with Tommy... well, friends with Tommy Wiseau before all of this happened.
Yeah.
Like, they actually knew each other. He wasn't just hired for this project.
No, which is really cool. I had no idea of, like, how much their relationship had already been established prior to the filming of this movie.
Yeah, nor did I.
And this is actually, like we said, based off of the novel, The Disaster Artist... There's a whole lot more to that name,
yeah,
that title.
Longer.
But that book was published back in 2013, and this film is based on all that talks about. So I guess going into this film, after freshly seeing The Room, I honestly only had one thing in mind, and that is this can only go up from here.
Definitely.
It can only achieve some type of you know... response of joy out of this film, rather than, because we already know this is a ridiculous film, The Disaster Artist is going to play off of that ridiculousness and just kind of amp it up. And so I'm like, all right, I need to make fun of this movie. I need to see people who are actually on my side of making fun of this movie and having a good time with it.
You're building camaraderie that way.
Exactly. So that's kind of my, that was my only expectation of this film, is that it can only go up from here. What about you, Chad?
My expectation for The Disaster Artist actually started months ago, before ever seeing The Room. I have actively avoided The Room for years, for what, 14 years, as it turns out, because it came out in 2003. So I've actively avoided The Room for 14 years, but then after reading so many of the reactions from the film festival circuit that The Disaster Artist received, even before the trailer was... available for all of us to see.
Yeah.
You know, announcing that, hey, we're going to release it right before award season. So hopefully James Franco gets an Oscar nod and maybe a directing nod and, you know, maybe some other people for some other things. But given the response that I read numerous, you know, reaction posts about and whatever, I really was excited for The Disaster Artist because it is one of those taking life throws you lemons and you make lemonade, mm-hmm. or like one man's trash is another man's treasure. And it's sort of one of those, like, the original project was so bad that some people considered it good because of how bad it was. But then here you've got like the behind the scenes scoop that's meant to be a good film. Like, it's not meant to follow in the footsteps of The Room and be a poorly produced, incoherent, terrible movie that is laughably awful. That's not what The Disaster Artist is supposed to be. So there's supposed to be some structure to it. You're supposed to care about the characters. And there's got to be something to keep your attention. So I was really expecting something pretty cool had we even not seen The Room. Now, saying that, I'm really glad.
Hold on. Take note, because this is very important to hear from Chad's mouth.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is that, like, backhanded exceptionalism coming back. I'm really glad that we watched The Room right before we saw The Disaster Artist, because there are a lot of small touches that I would not have gotten at all. It wouldn't have registered on my radar that it was even supposed to be noticed,
like,
had we
booty?
Not just seen The Room. Well, that is... they dwell on that for a while, and The Disaster Artist as well. But some of the other, you know, smaller touches, like some of the actual lines of dialogue that, say, James and Dave Franco have with each other before the script is even made in the storyline of The Disaster Artist, they are lines of dialogue from The Room.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes his real life experiences and conversations and translates them into what one may call a script. I would not be that one, but he certainly was one who called it a script. So my expectation level was high.
Yeah.
I just didn't want it to overly embrace all of the oddness of The Room, to the point that The Disaster Artist was also incoherent and you weren't quite sure what it was by the time it was over.
What about you, Spence?
My journey started 3 years ago.
Oy vey.
No, but what? Like,
I am already loving this response.
No, but like, it was about 3 years ago when they did the initial announcement that Franco had the rights to the movie of The Disaster Artist. And I was already on board then. I was like, oh, okay, this has to be good. Like, so I was just like, I put it in the back of my mind, and I bided my time waiting for it to come out. Because I just knew this movie was going to be something special. And when that first trailer finally hit, of James Franco as Tommy Wiseau on the roof, trying to do that scene of I did not hit her. Is that true?
I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
I was like, oh, I'm so down for this movie. So I was very excited when this movie finally came.
See, here's the thing. So like I said, my knowledge of the film was, prior to actually us seeing it, wasn't very vast. So I knew of the major scenes. I knew of a lot of the major key parts of the film. I had even seen a compilation of all the worst scenes in the film. They have that on YouTube. But I was still hesitant because, oddly enough, I'm not a huge James Franco fan. Like, I'm just not a fan of his works. I'm not a fan of his humor. I think a lot of the movies that he does is solely based on the grotesque humor of it all, rather than, or even like the really raunchy humor, as opposed to actual, what I consider personal.
So you're
humor.
Talking about specifically his comedic films.
Specifically.
Because he does dramatic ones too.
True. That's very true. But seeing as how much this film was going to lend to its more comedic roots based on the movie that it's based on, that was a lot of based ons.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be more into that realm. So that was one of my hesitant mindsets when I saw that trailer. I mean, it was great and all, but still, I'm not a huge James Franco fan. I'm not a fan of most of his films. And so that was my only, like, kind of hesitancy coming into this film, is that I would like to hope that this film is successful and it's getting a lot of praise and whatnot, but I
So would
don't
it be
like
safe
him.
To say if it was somebody other than James Franco embodying Tommy Wiseau in this film, you would have had higher hopes, but because it was James Franco, you just weren't quite sure.
Yeah, I think initially a lot of my thoughts were if it was anybody but James, and I think I remember saying this to you either on or off the air, is that if it was anybody but James Franco, I would be 100% sold out for this. But because it's him, I don't know. I just...
Well, I mean, your alternative, as is made very clear, right, in The Disaster Artist, would be Johnny Depp.
And even then, that would have been horrible, because then Tim Burton would have wanted to take over or something.
Oh, gosh. Tim Burton music would not fit with this movie at all.
But that was my biggest concern. Like, I didn't mind them wanting to riff on everything that happened behind the scene. I think that's a great, you know, perspective to have on a movie, especially if there's source material to work from. And
yeah,
there was.
Because, again, this is definitively an adaptation of the book,
yeah,
not an adaptation of The Room. Thank goodness.
So that was a stellar thought in my mind. But the people who were on staff to direct and star, which was both James Franco, I don't know. That kind of had a little bit of hesitancy in my mindset coming into this. Because you mentioned that he does a great Tommy Wiseau in that trailer. And I saw that trailer too, and I thought it was good. But I'm like, that's that one scene. Like, I wonder about the rest of the film. And needless to say, I was 100% wrong in my hesitancy. Because James Franco completely disappears into this role. Like, we've talked about actors who have had the ability to just totally become invisible on screen and you see that person or that right. character that they're embodying. This was one of those instances where James Franco was completely and utterly Tommy Wiseau in this movie.
How crazy is it as we look toward awards season that the two front runners for a best actor nod, at least, at this point, seem to be James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, that's an important footnote, and Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, both completely disappearing into their roles. I don't know that it's going to end up being much of a contest necessarily, yeah. But in what universe
well,
would you have a performer embodying Winston Churchill and a performer embodying Tommy Wiseau potentially going head-to-head for Best Actor awards,
I think,
throughout awards season?
I think
that
the one thing...
Nuts.
The one thing that we're overlooking is it's Gary freaking Oldman. Like, that man can do no wrong. He's done incredible. He could have stepped up and said, oh, I'm going to do a movie where I personify or I embody the principal from down the street, the high school down the street. And if we know what he does and how he looks and whatever, then we're like, oh, yeah, totally. He'll get an Oscar nod for that.
But still.
But I do see
your point. Churchill and Tommy Wiseau. Hello?
I get what you're saying.
It's crazy. It's mind-boggling. It's zany. And it's a lot of fun. And it's completely earned, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Honestly.
Well, and going back to like the film festival circuits that we talked about earlier this year, there was a lot of buzz coming out of those things. Like, a lot of people were talking about it. A lot of people were mentioning how they couldn't give specifics about the film because of an embargo and whatnot. But that the film was stellar, the film was out of this world, the film was great, that James Franco does a phenomenal performance. And I'm thinking, this is based on The Room, right? This is...
We're all using the same source material here, right?
You guys all saw the same film that we're supposed to be seeing in December, so that kind of just... I don't know. What were you thinking when a lot of people were coming up, Spence, with their thoughts and their critical praise?
I mean, you've
been
following this longer than we have.
It's true.
Yeah, when I started seeing Oscar nods, I was like, wait, what's happening? Because that does not make any sense. I was like, what? Like,
The Room and Oscar nod don't really work in the same sentence.
Like, I've definitely fallen into some parallel universe somehow.
You're in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, but now seeing the movie, like, it's still crazy, but I understand why people are saying it, because it's really a fantastic job.
And I can only imagine it cannot be an easy task as a performer and a director on this project for James Franco to embody and become Tommy Wiseau.
Oh,
it's
man.
Not like... It's not the same as like somebody who simply, let's say, simply has like a limp or a lisp or like a certain nervous tic, and you've got to really get that, you know, down precisely.
Yeah.
His entire demeanor, his cadence, his like mental focus ever, it's all over the map all the time and mostly incoherent. There's also like an accent that nobody can quite place exactly where it comes from in the real life Tommy Wiseau.
Mm-hmm.
And so James Franco has to get to know all of that well enough to replicate it nearly perfectly at all times, whether it's a recreation of a scene from The Room or a recreation of some real life event, you know, in a diner or something between the two real life guys who made the movie together, you know?
Well,
I mean, it's bonkers.
Well, it's probably also one of the reasons why some of the stories leaking from the set were that he was just in that character the whole time, while actually being himself, James Franco, and directing the movie, he was still...
Yeah, because if you let it slip once, you might not get it back.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's like, for me, after seeing The Room, and like I said, after the wondrous knowledge of YouTube, of seeing all the clips of the way Tommy Wiseau is, and the way he acts, and the way he speaks... I don't know if I'd want to slip into that personality. I don't know if I'd want to stay that, like, oh, hi, Chad. Yeah, we go here. And, oh, I did not hear her. I did not. It's like, I don't know if I'd want to stay in that.
I don't know. I think that you're making a run for it. I think, oh, I know. On the inside, I think you really do.
Oh, heck no.
It's really interesting. I do have to say, to put this in the context, about a week before we went and saw... The Disaster Artist, we viewed on Netflix a documentary about Jim Carrey.
Yes.
The Man on the Moon, right? Where he's, it is the Man on the Moon, right? Not the Man in the Moon. I always confuse it. It's the Man on the Moon.
The Man on the Moon.
And it talks about his method acting, like, process for
what
that film.
Andy, it's a documentary called Andy and I.
Yeah.
And it's insane, like. Yeah, go ahead.
And he had to embody multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
He had to embody Andy Kaufman, but also, what is it, Tony?
Tony Clifton.
The main character that Andy Kaufman kind of, in a way, was known for, but sometimes it was his best friend doing it instead and not actually Andy. Anyway,
Tony Clifton.
People on the set, they didn't know if they were getting Andy or Tony. They certainly were never getting Jim.
Yeah.
Because Jim was always submerged into one of the personas. And it didn't matter what was being filmed that day, the one that you met in the trailer getting makeup might have been one that didn't have a scene. Like, it could have been you met Tony, but they were doing a scene about Andy, but it was Tony who was speaking through. Like, it's bonkers. It's like
it was
schizophrenic. Like, it's like multiple personality.
Oh yeah,
bonkers to like hear what happened through the making of that movie, and then I'm applying that knowledge then to James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, never breaking from character so that he didn't lose it, like lose the character.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only imagine what that might be like for that mentality to kind of dominate your every waking moment as you're not only playing the character, but he was like producing and directing this film.
Yeah.
Like, he was calling all the shots as the director as Tommy Wiseau.
and
it wound up being good.
It wound up being really good. And it's interesting that you bring up, because I was actually thinking about it as well, that documentary that we saw on Netflix, which is still available on Netflix if you want to check it out. It's really interesting. Jim Carrey talks about how he was ultimately possessed or something by Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton or whatever, but that's... Jim Carrey's nuts. So let's just put that out there for right now. Either that or
although
he's a genius in terms of like...
He's extremely well-spoken and calm and focused in the interview segments in that documentary. But yes, clearly, he's not afraid to go exploring, let's say.
that's
psychologically.
But if the known method actors that we've had over these last, let's say the last decade, have shown that there can be incredible acting at... obviously really high costs and sacrifices.
Right.
If you look at individuals like Abraham Lincoln.
D- Daniel Day-Lewis.
You look at him and what he's done to stay in character. Like, for instance, we've talked about this with his role in Gangs of New York,
right?
Where he actually took on a part-time job with a butcher in that part of England and would actually walk around England in character and pick fights with people to stay in character. Likewise with Leonardo DiCaprio, who would go to the extent on the film The Revenant,
right?
Eating like actual body parts from horse,
raw bison, I thought,
or bison,
like buffalo heart or whatever. But and for what gain? I don't know.
You can see, like, Chad has high regard for Leonardo DiCaprio.
Well, no, I mean he did a fine job in the film. The film was way too long, but that particular scene, I don't know that it really mattered that it was real instead of fake. Like, I don't know what the gain was.
Oh,
it was,
yeah,
it was a gain for him, not for his performance or for the audience.
Yeah.
Like, we would have still registered it. If it was a fake animal part, we would have still registered that the character was eating the real animal part.
Yeah.
So the fact that the actor was eating the real animal part, that was really only for him. Like, it didn't really... I don't know. Anyway, that's soapbox moment. I'm off the soapbox. But
I say all that to state that people who put themselves through that type of process, if you will,
yes,
usually comes at a cost, whether physically, emotionally, even spiritually at times.
Because projects usually go a minimum of 2 months.
Yeah.
Depending on your role in them. And if you're a prominent character actor, you know, if you're a prominent role, then you could be on that project for 4, 5, 6 months when you've got your rehearsals and your production and your post-production process. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be doing it for half a year.
How meta would it be if they did a movie or a documentary on the making of the Disaster Artist?
I would watch it.
I'd be interested in seeing, like, the interactions between...
It never ends. It just doesn't.
It would be interesting to see the interactions between Tommy Wiseau and James Franco, and seeing how he learned to pick up on all those, you know, nuances, and the way his inflection goes this way, and the way he doesn't exactly stare at you when he's talking at you, but then you know he's talking to you because of the way he looks, or the way one eye is like this and the other eye isn't. And
yeah, it's interesting. Now, aside from James Franco, there are a lot of people in this movie.
There really are.
Like, a lot of people. From the beginning, you're almost immediately like, I know that person. I know that as performers. Like,
yeah.
I know him and her and her and him and her and her and him. Like, all of the, like, it's like James Franco and his amazing super friends of performers. Like, because you've got, you know, obviously his brother Dave plays the other lead in the film. His sister-in-law, Alison Brie, is a fairly prominent character for a portion of the film. You've got Seth Rogen. They've collaborated numerous times in front of and behind the camera, and he makes a fairly prominent play here. But then you've got, you know, other surprises.
Yeah. You got cameos from, like, Melanie Griffith at the early part of the film, who plays an acting coach. You have Sharon Stone,
who I didn't even recognize it was Sharon Stone.
Yeah, who plays the agency owner or whatever she is.
Yeah, she owns a talent agency that Dave Franco's character gets represented by, ultimately.
You get an appearance from director Judd Apatow.
Yep.
Which was really interesting. There's a lot of different things that pop up, and I'm pretty sure for people who are a little bit more knowledgeable in this particular area with faces and whatnot, they probably could pick out a lot more names that are in the film. But the film is peppered throughout the entirety of it with little cameos like this.
Yeah. One of my favorite was Jackie Weaver as the potential mother-in-law, the actress who plays the potential mother-in-law, Lisa's mother. I was like, okay, I saw her face.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait for her to do like a line reading as the actress playing the character. I was like, that is inspired. I can't wait for her to open her mouth and speak in character. And then she had some really great moments for me in the Disaster Artist as well. You've got Josh Hutcherson.
Oh my gosh.
Who is the embodiment of
the actor who
Pervy
plays
Denny.
Yeah, Denny.
Zac Efron had a fantastic turn
as Chris R. That entire scene was just hilarious.
I didn't even realize that was Zac Efron at first.
Yeah, he's gotten pretty big for that particular. I don't know if it's just for that
yeah,
role,
beanie,
or
you know, the beanie obscured.
Well, and
a
even
too.
Like I, it might just be like the layers or whatever. But he seemed a little bit bulkier in terms of like muscular structure.
Well, I mean, he's been pretty buff for a while. I think.
I don't know.
I mean, he was going toe to toe with The Rock a little bit with whatever the
Baywatch.
I mean, not toe to toe, literally. Like they could, he couldn't bench the same amount, but in terms of the physique,
true. But yeah, there's a lot of fun little cameos throughout this movie. And like I said, if you're more knowledgeable in this area, you know, I'm pretty sure you're going to catch a ton more. We were just like quick off the fly, like, oh yeah, that was so-and-so, that was so-and-so. Oh, that was her, that was that. There's even a really fun cameo at the very end.
Yeah, there's a stinger after the credits.
Yeah.
That you'll want to stick around for.
But the film does a really great job, I think. One of the things that's really notable about this film is its balance of creating a unique yet still positive story about Tommy Wiseau. Because this could have easily been a bash fest of like, oh, this is ridiculous. He's just totally off his rocker. He's totally out in left field. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know how to write. He doesn't know how to act. He doesn't know how to perform. He doesn't know how to direct. But I think
all of which they managed to say in this film. In a loving way.
In a very loving way, but it still kept the respect, I guess is probably the better word, the respect and the positive view of Tommy Wiseau as somebody who created something that in some form or fashion brings joy to moviegoers. And I think that's a really unique and a really interesting perspective to take, especially if you're somebody who is looking for a way to make a lot of money off of this film. Like if this film was a complete poke fest, I think a lot more people would be like, oh yeah, that's great. That's funny. You know, you have a lot of people like that out there who would flock to theaters. But I think because this
if you tried to make it a straight drama where it's like, oh my gosh, this guy wasted all this money and nobody liked him or his project or what. And like you tried to be overly saccharine about it versus like, go ahead and lean into what people have been loving about this film for 14 years, which is how much it makes them laugh because it doesn't make any sense. Like, go ahead and lean into that and you'll have a good project, you know, to kind of, I don't know, homage is, again, too strong of a word, but tap into that. You know, go ahead and tap into what's been working for people while also expanding our awareness of the story.
Spencer, for this particular film, as it's shedding light on The Room, how much of the information were you unaware of in terms of the movie, The Room?
Oh, pretty much most of it. Because because I haven't read the Disaster Artist book. It's on my reading list, which is way too long. But yeah, most of the things that they covered were things I just didn't know. But I'm also kind of glad that like they made him a human in a way that I wasn't expecting, like actually felt for this guy, which is kind of weird when you really have only seen The Room before and you're like, this is a bunch of nonsense. So it was really interesting.
And I think that's a really good point you bring up in terms of creating a persona for Tommy where people can view him as human. Because right now, aside from the Disaster Artist, you think of Tommy Wiseau in The Room, you think of this, you know, really gaudy performer, this individual who's just so mysterious and just so aloof, like you have no idea about this guy at all. But then you see the Disaster Artist and you see that humanity that's brought to that character, to that person, you know, and you actually, like Spencer said, you begin to feel for him. You begin to see, all right, maybe this guy isn't as like out there as we think. Like there is still a sense of...
It's definitely one of those weird things where you... As you're going through the Disaster Artist, and especially by the time you get to the end, I was sitting there thinking, okay, there really is more to this guy.
Yeah.
But there's not more to this guy. Like, it's a consistent sameness, but there's something that underlies it.
That's
that
like a slight rise and then just a drop right there.
Nobody's really tapped into it. He's still an enigma. Like, he maintains this persona. I mean... Parts of his identity have to be a persona because there are key questions like, where were you born? How old are you exactly? that he will not answer correctly. Yeah. Like, he either doesn't know how to accept the truth, or he just long ago decided not to share the truth. Where did you get all the money? Because the money was real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He didn't, like, he didn't launder money and make it up or take credit out. Like, he had millions of dollars to pull from to make this project happen, and even, he did.
Even prior to when the film started, like, you're realizing this guy who's showing up at some, you know, acting class is driving away in a brand new Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
He has a huge apartment in New York.
San Francisco, sorry. And L.A.
In San Francisco, and he has another apartment in L.A.
And who knows where else.
Exactly. And it's like, all right, this guy's got some cash on him. I mean, it's not just like some guy who's just flashing it for the sake of appearances. This guy is bankrolled.
Yeah, but at the same time, by the time you get to the end of the film, and you're picking up along the way, you know, because of how he integrates certain episodes from his experiences with Greg, Dave Franco's character,
yeah,
and he integrates them directly into the script, and I use scare quotes, the script for The Room, you can see that he's, you know, that art imitates life for him. He's using his own experiences, as confusing and incoherent as they are, and translating them into this project. And so you're left thinking, okay, so I don't know any more about this guy than I knew going in, but I know that there is more to him.
Mm-hmm.
The enigma is still pretty much fully in place 14 years later. I mean, like, in real life, they have a little in-title bit that happens before the credits that says, I don't remember the exact words, but nobody knows his age, nobody knows where he was born, nobody knows how he made his money to this day. Like, people still don't definitively know. The key questions about him that several of the characters bring up numerous times in The Disaster Artist, people still don't know the answer.
Here's a super random question, and I want to pose it to everybody here, but I kind of want to gather Spencer's answer first because I think it'll probably be the quickest one to come about. Chad will may need a little bit more time. Spencer, if you could choose any character role, either in film or in literature, to have Tommy Wiseau play, who would you like to see Tommy Wiseau portray in a movie?
Ooh, that's a great question. I love this question.
Oh, I know. I think I would like to see him portray Doc Brown from Back to the Future. Oh, hi, Marty.
Marty, you're tearing me apart.
Three movies of that would be amazing.
Oh, mercy.
Chad?
Having seen The Disaster Artist, I feel a little, I'm conflicted about how my answer came very quickly. I'd like to see him play Mr. Hyde, as in Jekyll and Hyde, but I don't think he could pull off Dr. Jekyll. He would need to play only Mr. Hyde. And this is a point that's made numerous times in The Disaster Artist, is that he is advised by an acting coach, teacher, person, and eventually his quote-unquote best friend, Greg, that he's only suited for villain roles because he's got this manic energy, doesn't make a lot of sense, and he's got facial features and the whole everything
look
about it, that it doesn't make sense for the hero of the story role. He makes sense as a villain. And so I feel a little bit like, oh, this guy really can't catch a break. Like, he really is suited to a villain. But I think, given his mannerisms and everything, I think he would make a fascinating Mr. Hyde.
So you're adding to the stereotype.
I am. I am. And I'm a little conflicted about it, but it's my honest answer.
Honestly, the first thing that comes to mind, and I know this is probably going to break hearts because of the fact of how much this is also a cult classic character, I would like to see Tommy Wiseau play Edward Scissorhands.
Never in a million years.
I would
never
love
in
to.
A million years.
I did not cut her. I did not. So with that, as we said, The Disaster Artist is a great movie. We're not going to dive too deep into it because we do want you to go check it out. It's now in theaters. Spencer, we'll start with you. Does it pass or fail, and how many monocles? Out of five. One out of five.
Definitely pass for me because, like, it's just a really excellent movie. For how many monocles? Ooh. Let's go with 4.5.
Ooh.
Out of five. I was very impressed with
it
this
movie. Oh, okay. Jed?
I would also pass. I would give this film a pass, and I would qualify it as a film. I think this has structure. It has some depth to it.
That
some
it
character development. Decent cinematography, nice soundtrack, essentially all the things that were missing from The Room. but then has a lot of the things that were from The Room. I mean, like, it clearly the people who made The Disaster Artist love and respect The Room.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
did not
yeah.
want to make this a bash fest on
yeah.
The Room.
Oh, yeah.
And I really appreciate that they did that. There's a whole series of side-by-side scenes heading into the credit sequence where it's got the scene from The Room side by side with the performers from The Disaster Artist. And you can see, like, time wise and mannerism wise, like, how closely they matched up,
which were really close.
I mean, uncanny in many cases, really, really impressive. And the places where they diverge were completely enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
The moments that were a little bit different. It was great. Anyway, all that to say, it passes. I would also give it a 4.5.
It passes for me. Out of everything else that you guys have said, I ditto it as well. The film is great, well written. You know, it has a great plot to it all. It's actually a very driving story because you know the end outcome of The Room and how that comes about, but you don't exactly know where the tale of creating this film ends out and, you know, how all characters at the end kind of resolve.
Right.
But it still is a great driving film. I enjoyed it. I would also give it a 4.5. It really does give a lot more knowledge and education and background to a film that could have ultimately slipped into the, like, crevices of you know, B-moviness and whatnot and totally not even come up in conversation. But because of a Disaster Artist, I really feel The Room is going to be coming back in a popular way of people wanting to see it, and we may even see, like, people watching it in theaters and whatnot.
I would actually, and I can't believe I'm saying this, I would recommend seeing The Room first.
If you're an adult, don't.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that. One of the things I loved about The Disaster Artist the most was the way that my questions and concerns from, like, 2 hours before seeing The Disaster Artist were, like, verbalized and shown by the characters in The Disaster Artist. Like, Jackie Weaver, her character, you know, we talked about it earlier, she plays Lisa's mother, and she randomly announces at one point that she has breast cancer, very awkwardly in the middle of a conversation, not about life-threatening,
nope,
you know, medical maladies, and then they drop it forever, and it's never brought back up. And so in this film, Jackie Weaver, as the actress performing that role, asks, like, does this ever come back up again? Like, do we ever pick up this thread?
Yeah.
And I'm like, thank you, because why put it in there if you're not going to have it matter?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
exactly.
Especially something big like that. You shouldn't put it in there if it doesn't matter to the quote-unquote story. And so I love that they verbalized that. They had other things. Basically, all of my reactions to The Room were shown somehow in The Disaster Artist.
It was.
And it made me love and appreciate both movies more.
You have to have some bruising on your ribs, because I know I elbowed you at least a few dozen times of, like, Chad, that was you. Chad, that was you during
you
theaters.
Said that.
So we obviously recommend you checking out The Disaster Artist, and if you have the opportunity, as Chad recommends, also seeing The Room beforehand so that you can get a full experience of these two movies and the whole medium as to which they're trying to give homage to. So, but yeah, it was a great conversation. Spence, thanks again for showing up and being on the show. You know, we always enjoy your witty humor and banter, so.
Hey, no problem. I enjoy being here.
So we're going to have to bring him back for probably another B-movie or something.
I mean, it can be a nice movie, too.
That's the thing. I don't think Spencer wants to come for just a nice movie. He wants
to come for a nice movie.
He could come for a nice movie. Yeah, Chad.
So bring me back during Infinity War.
What is that?
We'll think about it.
Infinity War? Why wait? Black Panther comes out in February.
Ooh.
Yeah.
See?
Well, there you go. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.